1967, Mahasi Searo gave a series of talks on a discourse called Sila Wanda Sutta. So this discourse is a very short discourse in the Sanyutta Nikaya. And Searo gave 16 talks on this very short discourse. So from the handouts, you know how long this discourse is. But when Mahasi Searo gave an exposition, he tried to make his exposition as complete as possible, and so he draw from other discourses and commentaries and put in his talks. So when the talks were transcribed and published as a book, the book contained about 500 pages, a medium-sized book. There is an English translation of that book. It is something like an abridged translation. But that translation is so unsatisfactory, at least to me, that I don't want to recommend that translation to anybody. So I thought I will give talks on the same sutta following the talks of Mahasi Searo. But I have only nine days or nine talks to give, while Mahasi Searo gave 16 talks. So you know, some things will be left out. But I will include what is essential for the understanding of this discourse and also understanding of the practice of meditation. And I want you to have the English translation of this discourse with you when you come to the talk. And this translation is taken from the translation of the Sanyutta Nikaya called Connected Discourses of the Buddha by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So my talk this time will be like a lecture given to the students in Burmese monasteries. The sutta reads like this. On one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahakotita were dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Now, there are two persons in this discourse. One was the Venerable Sariputta and the other Venerable Mahakotita. Now, Venerable Sariputta was too well known to need any introduction. I hope you all know who the Venerable Sariputta was. So he was the first chief disciple of the Buddha, and he was declared to be foremost among those disciples who possessed wisdom. So he was second only to the Buddha in the field of wisdom. But the other venerable, the Venerable Mahakotita, was not as well known as the Venerable Sariputta. You don't hear much of him. But he was also declared by the Buddha to be foremost among those who possessed the four kinds of analytical knowledge, or Patisambhida. Now, arahants attained four kinds of analytical knowledge, and also those who have reached enlightenment attained the four kinds of analytical knowledge. For example, the Venerable Ananda, he was only a Sotapanna during the lifetime of the Buddha, but he was described as one who had attained these four kinds of analytical knowledge. And his name here in the English translation is Mahakotita, with a T at the end. But in the 6th Buddhist Council edition, his name was here Mahakotika, with a K at the end. But in other 6th Buddhist Council editions, I mean in other discourses, his name was given as Mahakotita. So in Burmese editions, both names are found. So whether his name is Mahakotita or Mahakotika, it will not make any difference in our study of this discourse. When the incident reported or recorded in this discourse happened, these two venerables were staying at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Now, I hope many of you have been to Varanasi and visited the deer park at Isipatana. It is a very famous place of Buddhist pilgrimage because it was here that the Buddha gave his first sermon, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma. So whenever we say deer park at Isipatana, people always think of the first sermon. But next time when you visit the deer park at Isipatana, please remember this Silavanta Sutta also. Although this sutta was not delivered by the Buddha, it was just the question and answers between two disciples. It was recorded in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and so this sutta is as authentic as those delivered by the Buddha. So while they were staying at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana, one day in the evening, the Venerable Mahakotita emerged from seclusion, approached the Venerable Sariputta, exchanged greetings, and said to him. Now, it is the custom of the disciples of the Buddha, especially those who had attained enlightenment, to dwell in seclusion in the afternoon. So when they stay in seclusion, that does not mean that they are just taking rest or they are sleeping. Actually, during that time, they entered into the attainment of fruition, and they spend the time dwelling in that attainment. So that attainment, the attainment of fruition, is something like a vocation for arahants and other enlightened persons. Because arahants and enlightened persons see this world as a burning house. So they don't want to be in this house, but they had to be in this house. So as much as they can, they want to get away even temporarily from this house of suffering. So what they did was they entered into this attainment of fruition. So during the attainment of fruition, their mind was on Nibbana, which is peace. So when consciousness takes Nibbana as peace, it is very peaceful, and so the person is also very peaceful. So those who are in the attainment of fruition did not experience dukkha or suffering. So they often entered into this attainment of fruition. And so these two venerables also, in the afternoon, they entered into this attainment of fruition. So here, the venerable Mahakotita emerged from seclusion. So he got out of that attainment because maybe it was a little late in the afternoon, and approached the venerable Sariputta. So he went to the venerable Sariputta, exchanged greetings. So it is customary again for disciples of the Buddha to exchange greetings with each other when they meet. And then he said to the venerable Sariputta. So the venerable Mahakotita said to the venerable Sariputta, "Friend Sariputta, what are the things that a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to?" Now the venerable Mahakotita seemed to be fond of asking questions. On another occasion, in another discourse, we found him asking questions again to the venerable Sariputta, many questions. I think as a person declared to be the foremost among those who possess the four kinds of analytical knowledge, he should be the one who answered, not asking. But he was always asking questions. And he asked the questions not because he did not know the answer of the questions, but he wanted the posterity to have respect for the teachings, because when they know that these teachings were discussed between the two great disciples, then the posterity will have more respect for the teachings. So that is why he asked questions to the Venerable Sariputta and got the answers. So he said, "Friend Sariputta," I don't know who was older, the Venerable Sariputta or the Venerable Mahakotita. During the time of the Buddha, monks address among themselves with the word auso, that means friend or something like that. So whether the other monk is older or younger, they may just use the word auso. So here also, the Venerable Mahakotita said, "Friend Sariputta." Even if the Venerable Sariputta was older than Mahakotita, it was allowable during the lifetime of the Buddha to address another monk as friend or auso. But after the death of the Buddha, now before he passed away, Buddha said to Ananda, after my passing away, older monks should address younger monks as auso, friend, and younger monks should address older monks as bhante, or venerable sir. So after the death of the Buddha, this form of address has come into being. And so nowadays, we would not use the word auso or bhante unless we know the wasa of the other monk. So if we do not know, then we would ask him, how many wasas are you? And then if he is older, then we may say bhante. And if he's younger, we will say auso. But during the lifetime of the Buddha, monks can freely address among themselves with the word auso. But it does not mean that nobody used bhante during that time, because there are teachers and pupils would address their teachers not as auso, because it is like colloquial, it is like disrespectful. So during the lifetime of the Buddha also, if a monk is too, the difference of age is great, then they may use bhante and auso. But generally, monks, when they address to each other, they use the word auso. And so here, the Venerable Gotida addressed the Venerable Sariputta as friend. So the Venerable Gotida asked, what are the things that a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to? Now, there are two words, virtuous and bhikkhu. A virtuous means a bhikkhu, a monk who is pure in his sila. Now, as you know, monks have to keep more than 200 rules. And when a monk can keep these more than 200 rules without breaking them, he is said to be virtuous. His sila is said to be pure. And also those that are just ordained are pure in sila, because they have not committed any offense. And also those monks who have broken some rules but had made amends or cure that offense, they are said to be pure in sila. So a monk who is pure in sila may be a monk who has not broken a single rule, or a monk who may have broken a rule or two, but who has gone through some procedure to get free from that offense. So such a monk is called a virtuous monk, or a monk pure in sila. And as I said this morning, purity of sila is an important factor, especially in the practice of meditation. So a person, even if he is a lay person, must be pure in sila if he is practicing meditation. Now, once a monk asked the Buddha to teach him in brief so that he could go to a secluded place and practice meditation And Buddha taught him to purify two things in the beginning. One is pure sila, and the other is right view. So according to that teaching, according to the answer given by the Buddha, a person should have these two qualities before he practices meditation. Because Buddha said, standing on that pure sila, you practice satipatthana, or four foundations of mindfulness. So purity of sila is an important factor. So a monk who wishes to practice meditation must first purify his sila. Now the word bhikkhu. So the word bhikkhu is nowadays translated as a monk. Originally, the word bhikkhu means one who begs. So a bhikkhu is a person who begs. But the begging done by bhikkhus is not the same as begging done by beggars nowadays. Bhikkhus would pick up their bowls and would go out to collect alms, to collect food. They would stand at the door of houses and they would say nothing. But people understand that monks expect them to give them some food. So the lay people would come out and offer to the monk some food, and then the monk would go to another house and standing without saying anything and receiving, accepting what is given. So that kind of begging is called noble begging. So what monks do is that noble begging and not the begging done by beggars. So it is very important that the word bhikkhu should not be translated as beggars. It would be very derogatory to the monks. There is another meaning assigned to the word bhikkhu, and that is one who sees danger in the round of rebirths. That means one who sees the round of rebirths as a dangerous place, as a frightful place, at a fearful place. So one has to go through many kinds of suffering when one is in the round of rebirths, when one is going from one life to another, being reborn again and again. And so it is actually a place that is to be feared. So a person who sees the round of rebirths as dangerous is called a bhikkhu. So according to this meaning, any person who sees danger in the round of rebirths can be called a bhikkhu, whether he is a monk or a lay person. But the word bhikkhu is technically used to mean monks, and so in many cases it means monks and not lay people. But sometimes lay people may want to be included in the monks when Buddha taught something to the monks. Now there is complaint by lay people that Buddha always talked to monks and not to lay people, and so they feel they were left out. But Buddha lived with monks, and so whenever he wanted to talk, he would talk to monks. And he would address monks whenever he wanted to say something. And so the word bhikkhu is used many times in the discourses and also in the Vinaya Pitaka. But according to that definition, in some cases, the word bhikkhu may mean lay people also. So this extension of meaning should not be carried too far. So when you see a sentence saying, if a bhikkhu cuts a tree, he comes to such and such an offense, you cannot say that bhikkhu means also a lay person. So in most cases, a bhikkhu means a monk and the disciple of the Buddha who has gone forth. So the question here is, what are the things that a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to? Now, carefully attend to means wisely attend to, or correctly attend to, or pay correct attention to. And the Venerable Sariputta answered, friend Kottika, a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging, as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, and so on. So this is the answer given by the Venerable Sariputta. Now, in the answer given by the Venerable Sariputta, there are the words, five aggregates subject to clinging. In some English translations of this word, it is translated as just five aggregates of clinging. So you should understand the meaning of this word correctly. Now, there are two things here, the aggregates and clinging. So aggregates and aggregates that are subject to clinging. That are subject to clinging means that are object of clinging, or that can be objects of clinging. So here we should understand first what clinging is. Now, clinging means holding on to something firmly. So when we cling to something, we take hold of that thing and we do not let it go. So that is what we call clinging. And here, or in the teachings of the Buddha, clinging is in brief of two kinds. Clinging is a mental state. So with that mental state, we cling to the objects. Suppose we see something beautiful. So when it is beautiful, we like it, and we want to possess it. We have strong craving for that thing. In that case, we cling to that object by craving. So we can cling to the objects by strong craving. Or in other words, things are, or things can be, the object of strong desire, strong craving, or clinging. And sometimes we have wrong views about the objects. We have the view that they are permanent, or they are soul, they are self, and so on. Or we may have some wrong views about the self. And we may take ourselves to be self, we may take beings to be selves or souls and so on. And so when we take some objects with that kind of wrong view, we are clinging to that object. So we can cling to the objects with strong craving or with wrong view. So anything that we can cling to, either with strong craving or by wrong view, is called aggregate subject to clinging. What are the things that we can cling to? They are the things we see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we touch, and we think of. So actually, everything in the world. So we can cling to everything in the world by strong craving or by wrong view. When we say, this is I, now we are clinging by wrong view. When we say, this is mine, then we are clinging by craving. And the things we can cling to are technically termed aggregates, or in Pali, khandas. They are called aggregates because they are understood in groups. And group here means not a group of different things, but a group of different aspects of things. Suppose there is the visible object. That visible object is just one unit of matter. There are 28 kinds of matter, and there, the visible object is one unit of matter. And that one unit of matter is called an aggregate. It is only one. It is not a group of many things, but it is called an aggregate. That is because that just one unit of matter can be of the past or of the future or of present. Since it can be of past, present, and future, we group these three together and call that one unit of matter an aggregate. The same with the other states, let us say mental state, feeling. Feeling is just one mental state, one mental factor, one chetasika. But that one chetasika is also called an aggregate because it can be of the past, of the future, of the present. It can belong to us internal, and it can be external. It can be gross, it can be subtle, and so on. Because of these different aspects they possess, they are called aggregate. So even one mental state is called an aggregate, even one unit of matter is called an aggregate. So technically, they are called aggregate, and as you know, there are five such aggregates taught in Buddhism. As practitioners of Vipassana, you should be familiar with these aggregates. And the names of them are given on the other sheet. Now let us, for the time being, ignore the words subject to clinging. So we have five aggregates here: form aggregate, feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, volitional formations aggregate, and consciousness aggregate. Now the first one, I prefer to call it meta aggregate rather than form aggregate, because any unit of meta, any meta is called meta aggregate. So meta aggregate, feeling aggregate, and so on. Now meta means something that changes with adverse conditions like heat, cold, hunger, and so on. So the meta can be found outside living beings as well as inside living beings. So meta can be found outside in the mountains and the trees and so on, and also it can be found in the living beings. It's feeling aggregate. Now you all know what feeling is. So feeling, pleasurable feeling, displeasurable feeling, and neutral feeling, and that feeling is called feeling aggregate. Although feeling is just one chetasika, since it has division into past, present, and future, and so on, it is called an aggregate. So the feeling chetasika or mental factor is feeling aggregate. And then the next one is perception aggregate. Now, perception really means a mental state that makes marks of an object. Now, whenever we experience an object, our mind or that mental state in our mind makes a mark of that object, so that when we experience this object later, we know what it is. So such making marks is what is meant by perception here. The function of perception is compared to carpenters making marks on timber. So when they build things, they make marks on the wood so that they know, say, which part is to be put where, or which part is to be cut off and which is to retain, and so on. So making marks like this is for recognition later when that object is experienced. So when you make a mark, it is for a future recognition. So whenever you encounter or you experience an object, there is a mental state in the mind that makes a mark of that. And that mental state is what is meant by perception here. So that perception or mental state is just one mental state, but since it has a division into past, present, and future, and so on, it is called a perception aggregate. And then the next one is volitional formations aggregate. Now this is a little difficult to understand. Volitional formations aggregate. There are mental states taught in Abhidhamma. Actually, there are 52. Feeling is one mental factor, perception is another mental factor, and the remaining 50 are collectively called volitional formations aggregate. Because among these 50, there is a mental factor called volition, or chetana in Pali. Because this group is headed by volition, or chetana, it is translated as volitional formations aggregate. Again, the word formation is the translation of the Pali word sankhara. I have explained sankhara many times. The word sankhara can mean both producer and product. Something that produces some other thing is called a sankhara. And something that is produced by some other thing, or that is conditioned by some other thing, is also called sankhara. So sankhara has at least two meanings: made or maker. So here, sankhara means maker. So they make something. So we must understand the word sankhara in the active sense. But in other places, like in the saying, all sankharas are impermanent, then the word sankhara means all that are conditioned, all that are made. But here the word sankhara means those that make, and they are translated as formations. Maybe there is no other word to adequately convey the meaning carried by the original Pali word. So these 50 mental states are collectively called sankhara aggregate, or in English here, volitional formations aggregate. Among them, there is volition or chetana, and this is one sankhara. Mindfulness is also sankhara. Understanding is sankhara. Attachment is sankhara. Hatred is sankhara. Delusion is sankhara. There are many sankharas. So all these are collectively called sankhara, because they do something. So when we see something, there is a kind of activity, mental activity in the mind that makes seeing complete. So that kind of mental activity is called sankhara. Now we'll explain it later again. So the sankhara aggregate consists of these mental states, 50 mental states. And the last one is consciousness aggregate. Now, consciousness is the awareness of the object. So here also, consciousness must be understood in its technical sense, and not as consciousness understood popularly. So consciousness in Abhidhamma is just the awareness of the object, a mere awareness of the object. And this consciousness is always accompanied by feeling, perception, and some factors from volitional formations aggregate. So these are five aggregates. Again, matter aggregate, feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, volitional formations aggregate, and consciousness aggregate. And when they are the object of clinging, then they are called aggregate of clinging, or aggregate subject to clinging, or aggregate objects of clinging. So now you know the five aggregates and five aggregates of clinging. Now let us see whether we can find the five aggregates in seeing something. So when we see something, there is the something to be seen, the visible object, and there are the eyes through which we see things, we see the object. And then there is the seeing. So seeing arises when the object to be seen comes into the avenue of the eyes. So there arises the seeing consciousness. So when we see with that consciousness. So now we see how many aggregates. The thing we see is rupa aggregate, matter aggregate, and the eyes are matter aggregate. And seeing is consciousness aggregate. So we have how many now? Two, right? Matter aggregate and consciousness aggregate. So when we see something, sometimes it is pleasurable, sometimes it is not pleasurable, sometimes it is neutral. And so there is the feeling also. Sometimes we say, it is good to see this thing, or it is not good to see this thing, and so on. And so there is a feeling also involved when we see. And as I explained, whenever we experience an object, our mind or a state of mind in our mind makes a mark of that object. That is why we recognize this object when we experience it later. So there is this perception also involved in the act of seeing. And also there are mental states that exert to bring this seeing to completion, to make some effort to see. It is very subtle, but if you really watch your mind, you will notice that there is some kind of activity, some kind of exertion in the mind to see, to hear, and so on. So that is the sankhara or volitional formations aggregate. So we do not have to find five aggregates in the books. We find them in our experience. So in our experience of seeing, we find these five aggregates. In the experience of hearing also, again, these five aggregates, smelling, tasting, touching also. When we touch something, there are these five aggregates. Now, with regard to touching, when we feel heat, this is also a touch. When we feel cold, this is also a touch. And when we are aware of the rising and movement of the abdomen, this is the rising and falling movement is the touch. If we feel a pressure there, then that is also a touch. So there can be many touch sensations in the body. And these can be detected, or these can be seen if you pay close attention to, say, what's happening at the present moment. And so in touching something also, there are these five aggregates. And just by watching what's happening at the moment, we can develop insight. We can develop penetration into the nature of things. When there is a movement, what happens is, first, there is the intention to move in our minds. We want to move. So there is the desire or intention to move. And that desire or intention to move produces what are called wind element matter. There are four great elements: earth element, air element, water element, fire element. So the particles of air element are produced by the desire to move. So when we have the desire to move, our mind, let us say, creates. Our mind creates or produces these particles of air element. The increase of these air element is what we call movement. So when there is the desire, then it produces the particles of air element, and the old particles disappear, and then there are new particles produced, and there are more new particles produced than there are those that disappear. And so that is what is called a movement. According to the strict teaching of Abhidhamma, there is nothing that moves. Can you believe that? So I'm moving my hand now, right? So there is nothing that moves. What seems to be moving is just the increase of the material properties caused by the desire to move, the air element, particles of air element. So every movement, although it seems to be a movement, is, according to Abhidhamma, not a movement at all. I think it can be proved. How? Have you been to a movie? Yeah? So you think that the on the screen pictures are moving, but you know that there are no moving pictures. They are all still pictures, projected one after another in different places. So when we see the screen, the illusion is created in our mind that the pictures are moving. But actually, pictures are not moving. What is moving is our imagination. So we connect all these things into a whole, and then we say, the pictures are moving. But actually, there are no moving pictures on the screen, but just the still pictures one after another. So similarly, when we move our hand, it is not the hand that moves, but the increase of the material properties of air element caused by our desire to move. So this we may see through practice of vipassana meditation. When you make notes of rising and falling of the abdomen, you are actually noting the air element. Because movement is the function of air element. And the air element is included in the sense of touch. So when you are aware of the movements of the abdomen, rising and falling, you are experiencing a kind of touch. And in that experience also, you can find the five aggregates. Matter, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So actually, in every experience, we can find these five aggregates, and these five aggregates can be clung to by way of a strong craving or by way of a wrong view, and so they are called aggregates of clinging or aggregates subject to clinging or aggregates objects of clinging. And it is these aggregates of clinging that we have to watch, that we have to be mindful of in order to get free from suffering. When we think of something also, there are these five aggregates. Now, we are not seeing with our eyes, hearing with our ears, but we are thinking with our mind. But when we are thinking, we see something in our minds, or we hear something in our minds, and so on. So those objects are called the past objects. So these past objects, if they are visible objects or audible objects, they belong to matter aggregate. And also consciousness must have a base for it to arise. That means if we do not have eyes, there will be no seeing consciousness. If we do not have ears, there will be no hearing consciousness. And then what about thinking? Thinking consciousness also needs a seat or a base. And according to Abhidhamma, that base is the heart base. So heart base means actually the blood in the heart. So with every experience of seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, or tasting, when we eat something, tasting, touching, and thinking, there are always these five aggregates. And if we do not watch them, if we do not apply mindfulness to these five aggregates, we will always cling to them, either by craving or by wrong view. Because they are objects that can be clung to, we usually cling to these objects, that is, if we are not mindful. So it is clear that in order not to cling to them, we must watch them. We must watch them when they are present. We cannot watch them when they are past. We may be able to recall some experience, the past experience to the present, but they will not appear as vividly as the experience at the present moment. So if we want to, if we want to avoid clinging to these five aggregates, we must watch them when they are evident, when they are there. Otherwise, we will always cling to these objects. When there is clinging, it does not stop there. We have clung to something. Suppose we are attached to a thing and we want to possess it, and then motivated by that desire to possess it, we will try to possess it. We will do something to possess it. We may steal it, we may drop it from a person, or we may even commit killing just to get what we want. So motivated by clinging, we do actions. Sometimes what we do is unwholesome, and sometimes it may be wholesome. Whether wholesome or unwholesome, since they are karmas, since they have the potential to give results in the future, we will get the results of these actions in the future in the form of rebirth. So when there is clinging, there is acting. And when there is acting, there is the result of that acting. And the result of the acting is in the form of rebirth in the future life. And with rebirth, there is aging, disease, death, and so on. And so we prolong the duration of our samsara if we do not watch, if we do not apply mindfulness to what we experience at the present moment. But if we are mindful, if we if we see them, see the objects as just the objects, and that they arise and disappear, so they are impermanent, they are suffering, and they are non-soul, then we will not cling to them. When there is no clinging, there can be no action. When there is no action, there will be no reaction as results. So that is why it is important that we be mindful, or we apply mindfulness to whatever experience we are having at the moment. So now it is clear that it is important not to cling to these five aggregates of clinging. And in order not to cling to them, we must watch them, or we must make notes of them. We must be mindful of them when they are present. So this answers the question, when are we to make notes of the five aggregates, and for what purpose do we have to make notes of the five aggregates? So the answer to when is at the present moment, and the answer to for what purpose is not to cling to them. So in order not to cling to them, we make notes of them as and when they arise, when they are still existing. And we are talking about the present moment a lot of times. And actually, the present should be understood as present as a duration, and not exact present moment. When we are mindful of something, most of them, most uh, most of that the things we observe have passed a little. It may be a tiny fraction of a second passed. For example, when we are mindful of anger, when we are making notes of anger, anger is no longer there, actually. It has disappeared. Because if there is anger, there can be no mindfulness. So the fact that you can be mindful of anger means that anger is not in your mind at that moment. It has already passed. But it is so, so brief a moment of past that in the context of vipassana meditation, we call it a present. So when we say, be mindful of the object at the present moment, sometimes it may be the real exact present, like when you are mindful of the breaths or the movements of the abdomen, because the abdomen is moving and you are making notes rising and falling, so they may coincide exactly. But when you are mindful of your thoughts, actually, they are already past when you are mindful of them. But since they are so close to the present, and in the context of vipassana, we call it the present, we say, be mindful of the present or be in the present moment. So when you practice vipassana meditation, what you have to keep in mind is to be mindful of the object at the present moment. And you try to be mindful because you don't want to cling to the five aggregates of clinging. And you don't want to cling to them because clinging leads to action and action leads to reaction, which is suffering, and you want to escape from suffering as soon as possible. So in order to get away from suffering, you watch what is at the present moment. So just by paying attention to the object at the present moment, you can get concentration, you can get penetration into the nature of things, and you can progress from one stage to another until you reach enlightenment. I think I told you about the elephants last year. Elephants are very intelligent animals. And many elephants are made to work moving logs of wood in the forest. So it is said that they have a sense of exactness that when the bell rings for to stop, they will stop right away. Even if it is only 6 more inches to push the log, they will not do it. So they will just leave it as soon as the bell rings. So somebody told me that talking more than 1 hour is not so good. After 1 hour, people get uncomfortable in your seats. And now I've been talking for 2 hours. But talking with a translation, I think 1 hour is not enough. So now it is 2 hours, and actually it is 5 minutes past 2 hours. And so I will follow the example of the elephants. Thank you.